This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Terry Mazzani, who is the president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust. In Terry's career, he also served 6 years ago as the interim chief of the Chicago Public School System. Currently, the Chicago Community Trust is working with 43 partner groups in a program called On the Table. This is where groups get together and listen more than talk about problems in their communities and what they can do to help solve some of these problems. Mr. Mazzani began by saying that Chicago and Mayor Emanuel have become very creative in finding ways of reinvigorating neighborhoods. He said the federal and state governments are obviously less able to fund programs for cities, so cities will have to figure out solutions for themselves. The major problem that the trust is working with is what he called social isolationism, a rise in distrust, decay of community bonds, and less respect, and all have life and death consequences. Focusing in on housing, access to capital to redevelop neighborhoods, equal justice, and educational needs will help alleviate some of these deleterious consequences. He said, Terry said, we have to solve these problems because they result eventually in huge losses in terms of revenue, property taxes, jobs. He said, we have to find groups that will break bread together among and between groups to minimize the differences between social and economic strata. The trust is committed to offering seats at the table for all those who have not been invited. And hopefully the conversations that are generated move from hopelessness to hopefulness. He cited examples in such neighborhoods as Englewood, the Ogden-Jenner school merger in the near North Side area, Chicago Police Department, St. Leonard's, which deals with former prisoners and convicts who've been come back to the community as they seek to involve groups in improving their neighborhoods. 22 cities, he noted, have adopted the on-the-table model. The need to form communities that are inclusive and work for everyone is number one on the table. He said there must be a reason why whoever created us gave us two ears and one tongue. We should spend more time listening than speaking.
Something I learned from the Chicago Cubs, you've got to have your own entry video and theme song there. So it worked out great. I want to thank Daniel Ash and the team for putting that together for that. Really enjoy the fact that we've got several current and former board members here. They've been identified, but Frank, who had served as chair, and Jesse and Jude Irwin and Jack Catlin over there, and Audrey Peoples, Mary Richards, and Lowry, fabulous to definitely have you there. And I think this is a unique distinction of probably the only gathering where the two interim CEOs of the Chicago Public Schools are here. Jesse and myself share that title for that. So thank you, Jay, and the City Club for once again providing me with this opportunity to share my thoughts and reflect on our state of the community. Not sure if in your conversations you're able to revisit your experiences with On the Table and the interesting and surprising things that you came away with here, but this timing is perfect for me to be able to reflect on what we heard across the city for the fourth year of On the Table. And a disclosure up front, given the reception that I had as people were getting to say, just to be aware, this is not that speech, okay? So it's not that speech. That is still in the future, okay? This is On the Table speech. So for those of you for those of you who came here thinking it was that speech, if you want to excuse yourself, I will understand. So, Jackie gets it. Because you don't want to miss that speech. Terry Unplugged is going to be something else. Yeah. Okay. Last week I came here for David Reifman's presentation. For those of you who also saw that fabulous citywide view of the new investments coming to our city. And I'll share with you kind of my reflections about that and how it looks from the resident point of view. But David describes that as kind of his shock and awe presentation, and I think most of us were exhausted by the time he finished, not because it was boring, but just because it was so massive in what he's leading there. And yet, I think he buried the headline. For me, the headline is that our city and our mayor are being incredibly innovative in finding new ways to finance new development. They're creating these new tools for funding underserved communities and neighborhoods where the traditional markets just are not working. And I think it's brilliant what they've done. The preview that we had of the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund that was released later in the week, 22 grants totaling $3.2 million to neighborhoods on the south and west side. It's what's needed, and they're figuring it out. I think that need was underscored during last week's Global Cities Forum hosted by the Council on Global Affairs, where it's clear not just in Chicago but across the country and the world that federal and state governments are much less able to provide the type of funding required for cities to flourish. We got to figure it out on our own. But the steps that the city is taking, they're not just about being smart, but I think they're core to our survival and viability. These investments in our most struggling neighborhoods are an important part of what it'll take to bring about a more inclusive Chicago where everyone matters and everyone is at the table. Columnist David Brooks frequently talks about the decline in social capital and social trust in our communities. In one column, he asks the question, what is the central challenge facing our era? His answer, social isolation, a reality especially true for communities down the income scale. Brooks goes on to cite studies showing that the rise in distrust correlates with a decline in community bonds. Distrust also feeds self-reinforcing spirals. Parents who experience distrust are less likely to teach their children about tolerance and respect for others. This experience has life and death consequences when the result of distrust of law enforcement is passed on from parents to children. Here in Chicago, our challenge is even greater because of the visible and invisible barriers erected by the enduring legacy of segregation that reinforces social isolation and blocks the formation of bonds of social capital that can only form when people are proximate to each other. You know the data as well as I do. The disparities have been measured and documented in virtually every facet of life. Housing and safe communities, access to capital and small business loans, food security and health care, education attainment and employment, income and wealth, and of course, unequal justice and mass incarceration. Every few months or so, a new report comes out to remind us of these realities. Most recently, the UIC Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy released their report entitled A Tale of Three Cities, The State of Racial Justice in Chicago. It examines the disparities experienced by not just African-American residents, but Latino residents as well. And there's the really smart study produced by the Metropolitan Planning Council and Urban Institute on the cost of segregation, funded by the trust in part as our broader strategy on racial inequity. What this study reveals is the incredible self-inflicted wound hindering our economic progress, the loss of $4 billion in potential income, $8 billion in potential regional gross domestic product, $6 billion in real estate value, 83,000 more people who most likely would have college degrees in our community. At the end of the day, we'd all like to see these figures reversed, but how to get there is where we get bogged down. I believe we all have a clear sense of the problem, especially those in this room, those of you who are leading and participating in our nonprofit sector. But the question remains, what do we do about this? There is no one entity or one solution to look to. We have to come at this from all directions all at once. It's about residents and grassroots leaders seated side by side with those who hold the formal levers of power and influence. It's about proximity. One approach that the Trust has taken is rooted in the oldest human traditions, breaking bread together, sharing a meal that invites, includes, honors, respects, and listens to the diverse voices and identities of our fellow community members. When we respect another's identity, we affirm their basic human dignity. We bring people together through On the Table to create that understanding that leads to empathy, that leads to mutual trust and social cohesion. These things are foundational to bring about any of the changes that are needed to achieve the outcomes that we desire. These are the conversations that we need to have more often, but most often don't. For its part, the Trust is convener and catalyst to tap the transformative potential of tens of thousands of residents working together to imagine and create a new shared future. The real magic happens when organizations and individuals start using On the Table as a platform to achieve their own goals. Our commitment is to offer a seat at the table for those not typically invited. Invite them to share their stories and help them turn their stories into actions that make a difference for their lives. But the real impact of On the Table is far deeper. Our shared conversations validate, honor, and respect the basic dignity of each and every person at the table. Our discussions bind us together in a stronger community with common and shared interests. We transform hopelessness into hope, cynicism into caring, disdain into compassion. Each year, I immerse myself in On the Table, morning to night. And this year, I was joined by John White, our Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, who documented my day and brought many of the images that you've enjoyed today. And there are still countless more to go. But John is back here. I want to give a round of applause. To So I began May 16th, On the Table Day, as it's officially called in Chicago, at a breakfast co-hosted by Saquon Lawrence of the Chicago Center for Art and Technology and Kerry Thomas of the Chicago Jobs Council, both of whom, Saquon injured his back over the weekend, so he's not here. So ShyCat, as it's called, and CJC invited a diverse group of guests to their table to explore a single topic, that of worker co-ops. In a co-op business model, ownership is shared by a group of workers rather than ownership by one or a few. Co-ops can mean a completely different experience for workers and communities, one of greater individual empowerment and prosperity more widely shared. But in Chicago, cooperative business models have not been widely understood or practiced. This on-the-table conversation brought together a powerful set of minds, nonprofit leaders, a lawyer, an architect, a banker, to discuss how we might encourage the growth of co-ops locally in order to improve conditions and build more wealth for our residents and communities. We heard from Armando Robles, who is a founder and owner of New Era, a cooperative that manufactures windows and doors. His group calls itself New Era because they hope it'll be an inspiration for how future jobs can be created in America. Armando told us that the challenges of starting and managing a co-op became their own rewards as workers learn to come together as a team to solve problems and seize opportunities. As one visitor to New Era put it, if you saw how engaged the workers were at this factory, you would think they owned the place. And indeed, they do. Armando's testimony inspired the group to commit to keep meeting in pursuit of this transformational idea, common elsewhere around the world, but not so here, in encouraging the growth of co-ops in our region. Why is this important? Because co-ops could provide a very real solution to the challenges posed by our rapidly changing economy, an economy where automation and the efficiency imperative threaten to not only destroy our jobs, but to strip the meaning out of jobs that remain. New Era is an example of ways to create quality jobs driving inclusive growth that affirms human dignity. And the thing about on-the-table conversations is they are inherently optimistic. During the course of a single meal, you might have observed the transformation in the dialogue from hopelessness, we can't do this, to hopefulness. In the case of the Shy Cat table, it was well summed up by the statement, we are participating in a movement to transform our economy. That is true empowerment. That is a big deal. There's a commitment to stay at the table and to stay focused on this challenge. As one person said, if we can struggle effectively and have arguments and express real concerns, we create social good. Moving on to Englewood, I want to highlight the Southside Occupational Academy, one of Chicago's hidden gems. Their principal, Josh Long, is with us today. And the Southwest Occupational Academy is an education and training center for young people with disabilities age 16 to 22. The classrooms at the academy are actually simulated work sites, a grocery store, a retail shop, an office, where students can learn job skills in a hands-on setting. It's a robust program, and the school's leadership saw an opportunity to make it even more impactful. What if the academy could build partnerships with businesses that could result in internships and even employment for their students? The school teamed up with Karen Tamley, our commissioner of the mayor's office of people with disabilities, to host an on-the-table that drew 20 businesses to the academy for a tour and conversation. By using on-the-table platform, Southside Occupational Academy was able to widen its network and begin to build lasting relationships that can make a real difference in the lives of its students. This is the work of repairing the fraying networks of social capital, one leader, one institution at a time. Last year, I spoke of the courageous school leaders and parents fighting for the merger of Ogden International School of Chicago, a thriving, predominantly white and affluent school, with Jenner Academy for the Arts, an under-enrolled, 100% African-American and low-income school in Cabrini-Green. Recently, CPS, thank you, Frank, announced that the Jenner-Ogden merger had been approved and will move forward. Much to my delight, I learned that the students at Lincoln Park High School are eager to help make this merger successful. These students are participate in We Schools, led by Francie Richard over here. It's a program that inspires young people to nurture their sense of compassion and commit to being positive forces for good in their communities. At an on-the-table conversation hosted in partnership with We, the students at Lincoln Park expressed their frustration with the prevailing stigma associated with a school so close to their neighborhood. These students know that change starts with them, so they have proposed the idea of creating a sister school relationship with the soon-to-be-merged Jenner Ogden School. I'm especially pleased with how On the Table is contributing to solve one of the greatest problems facing our city. From the first day he was appointed, Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson recognized the challenge to restore trust between police officers and residents, thanks to the tireless efforts of Robin Robinson and Vanessa Wesley, who are also here, and dozens of CAPS officers. CPD has embraced On the Table as one way to do just that. Over the past 12 months, the Chicago Police Department has been holding on-the-table conversations as a way of building deeper connections and trust within the communities it serves. This year, for May 16th, the Superintendent Johnson directed every district to host a conversation with a focus on race and equity. The Trust partnered with CPD to ensure that every officer received facilitation training. As you can imagine, the prospect of hosting such a conversation was a daunting one. But the week after On the Table, we followed up with the officers to see how the conversations went. Even the ones who went into it with uncertain expectations said they found the experience profoundly meaningful and worthwhile. This is how On the Table can be a powerful tool to build bridges and create new narratives. On the Table can also provide an open forum for residents to speak truth to power. As Winston Churchill once said, courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen. In Washington Park, Cecilia Butler, who is also here, organized a table of residents who were nervously anticipating the development of the Obama Center to the east and the seemingly ever-present University of Chicago adjacent to them. Now, Cecilia is known to be outspoken and persistent, if not insistent. And while there are many of the venues in which she speaks are charged with emotions in politics that generally tend to close our ears to others' concerns, On the Table gives us a chance to really listen with sympathetic ears. During the course of such a conversation, we can put ourselves in the shoes of Washington Park residents and hear what they're really feeling and experiencing. So picture yourself as a 70-year-old resident renting an apartment in a senior living facility, living off of a modest fixed income that is never going to magically become more than it is. And you're reading about these big plans all around you, and yet you have 30, 40, 50 years of experience with other grandiose plans that did not improve your situation one bit. You still have no cleaners, no grocery store, no restaurant in the neighborhood. And today your neighborhood feels even more unsafe than in years past. As one resident said, we can't keep our grandkids here. It's too dangerous. And I've lost my niece. Typically in this reality, you're not invited to these tables. To find answers, you must piece together the truth from fragments of incomplete information. Public meetings are called sham summits because your voice hasn't made a difference. You question, what's the point of me coming out, because you won't listen to me anyway. Your reality is summed up by the brutal truth expressed by one resident. This is a mean world. I just don't trust folks. But if you listen closely, what On the Table allows for is a glimpse of the underlying anxiety, distrust, and pain of countless indignities. This is not about wanting a say in the architectural design of the Obama Center or its programming. The real concern, as I heard it, is this. When the Obama Center is created and other investments are made by the university, rents will rise, land will become more valuable, the landlord that I'm renting from will have an incentive to sell the senior housing units for upscale housing. And remember, you are a 70-year-old resident living on a fixed income in a neighborhood which is where you've built your life. Where do you go? How do you even contemplate making a fresh start? Is that really possible? And then let me share with you dialogue from the table hosted by St. Leonard's Ministries, whose mission is to help those returning from prison to turn their lives around and become contributing members of our community. Everyone I talked to there said the same thing. They said, how can I give back to the community that I helped to destroy? We want to give back to the community, we just don't know how. In many cases, it's about very basic things, things we may take for granted, but if you've never experienced these things, how do you know? Questions like, what is your responsibility to a lease? I never had a lease before. How do I be a good neighbor and respect my landlord? In the reality, I'm scared to walk down the street because they, meaning the police, could say I'm gang affiliated just by being in proximity to other gang members and put me back in jail. And profoundly spoken. One person said, "Don't nobody have a plan to go back to the penitentiary?" But they all agreed what you need is a good, strong family to take you by the hand. That is what St. Leonard's is about, repairing broken lives, returning to broken communities. Their work is best summed up by a volunteer who's been there 20 years to help ladies with clothes and self-esteem. Her invitation was simply, "Walk with me." We all need St. Leonard's to make our community whole, to heal our fellow community members, to reconnect them in a loving and dignified way. In the face of discriminatory policies that have resulted in mass incarceration, we need many more St. Leonard's houses. And St. Leonard's should not have to struggle for funding from the state that is responsible for those individuals that it serves. That's where the table hosted by the Civic Federation and Lawrence Massal comes in. They use their on the table to engage civic partners to agree on a public statement demanding that our elected officials not come home from Springfield until they've passed a budget. I also want to talk about our partners who have scaled their on the tables, like Kennedy Forum and others, but they've made it about their missions, their priorities to rebuild our communities. I'm especially inspired by the leadership of Cardinal Supich, who has come out very publicly in his leadership of the 2.2 million Catholics in Cook and Lake counties with a plan to engage all 345 parishes in his anti-violence initiative and the Instruments of Peace Fund. What I find most powerful about his vision is his moral insistence that none of us can turn our backs on this violence. He intends to link his more affluent parishes with those serving our most distressed neighborhoods. His message: we all share a responsibility to act. Which leads me to the Acting Up Awards. Our effort to stimulate more follow-up, moving more ideas into action. Last year when we tried this, we received nearly 400 proposals, made grants of $1,000 apiece to 72 of those ideas, like a group of residents seeking to destigmatize mental health or a sixth grade class designing a coloring book to help adults more effectively counsel abused youth. The success there has led us to renew the program, and we again received grants, and these are unique grant applications. It's a two-minute video. Not a single piece of paper was harmed in the process of this grant solicitation there. We have reviewers hard at work now, and the submissions and awards will be announced on June 30th, so keep your eye out for that. Now, earlier in my remarks, I referenced David Brooks' social commentaries that reflect on the state of our nation. Chicago's experience with social isolation and distrust, the decline in social capital, are also playing out in other communities around the country. How do we know this? Well, one indicator is you'll be proud to know that 22 cities have adopted On the Table and are implementing this model. It is spreading. And thanks to the interest and funding by the Knight Foundation, there are 10 cities where Knight newspapers were published that are also replicating this model. I think this speaks to our national deep-seated need to form communities that are inclusive, caring, and work for everyone. And at a time when philanthropy is focused on metrics and measurable outcomes, I'm afraid that we dismiss things that also matter but are more difficult to measure, things like hopefulness, trust, dignity, and caring. For any of you who have engaged in the efforts to try to prevent or reduce violence, it all starts with we need to create hope. I think that is a very tangible outcome that we need to talk about. And based on the experiences of On the Table, I'm more and more convinced that civic engagement is a valuable outcome in and of itself. People coming together matters. People making their voices heard matters. The conversations that you shared today over lunch matter. I think On the Table has become a civic institution in Chicago, our day to celebrate the practice of civic engagement. On this day, we schedule time to meet, and we take time to listen. By coming together, we understand each other and increase the empathy quotient in our city. Conversations lead to commitments. Commitments lead to actions, actions benefiting each other and our common cause. Not only does On the Table trend number one during the day, but I'm pretty sure that we also trended number one for kindness and caring on that day as well. And I'll let the poet Gwendolyn Brooks, whose 100th birthday was recognized last week, but I'll let her have the last word here. To quote her, "We are each other's harvests. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond." Thank you for letting me share my experiences with On the Table.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you very much. Don't go away. If you have any questions, just hold up your blue card and Amanda of our staff will come by. Max of our staff, I see there are some being picked up. I see there's one right down here. Okay, this is from Kirsten Chernofsky. I hope I didn't butcher your name, so I apologize. She's with the Erie Neighborhood House. How will the trust continue its commitment to racial equity? Will the trust provide funding and resources for partner nonprofits to encourage and invest in capacity building to ensure racial equity, diversity, and inclusion at all levels of the organization, including the board of directors?
That's a great question. I know that the board of the trust and senior leadership there are absolutely committed to racial equity at the center of all that we do. And you saw that built into this year's On the Table. About 1,000 people received training to be able to facilitate conversations about race and inequality there. And that was an important first step. We didn't want to go wall to wall with On the Table and presume or preempt what other people may want to talk about. But the fact that we had projected training for 500 people and had twice that number participating, I think says a lot. The experience of the Chicago Police Department and what Robin is leading there is another indicator of that. It's actually a fascinating broader topic in terms of if we think about the changes that have to come about, it's at the individual level, the organizational level, society-wide for us, and then at a policy level, which has so many drivers of racial inequity that we experience day in and day out. And I think that there are a number of groups working on this. There are a number of reports that come out. And I think one of the key roles that the trust plays is to aggregate and amplify the efforts on behalf of all who are focused on addressing racial inequity.
Thank you. This is from Rana Frazen with one of my favorite organizations, the Chicago Public Library Foundation. Terry, what are the biggest surprises that have come from On the Table, and where do you see the greatest opportunities for the future?
But this year, what was fascinating was that cutout of the kind of quote bubble became a thing. people used that. And we have lots and lots of pictures of that. It was very attractive for that. I think that the continued growth is astounding, and I think it just happens that it's now got a geometric growth progression, doubling in numbers every year. So my colleagues will not like me to throw out a word like, well, that means like 2018 should be 200,000 people participating. But I didn't say that here. It's not captured on the video, so that won't be a problem for that. What happens is the fact that it's become a verb that we on the table our conversation or something. It's becoming self-organizing. Daniel Ash had the vision, well, we should program an entire week, but we thought that might be too ambitious. Turns out that the day of on the table is now about a month long and still happening. As people see that it gives a certain framing for how to host a conversation that's inclusive around meaningful issues for that. And so that extends. And then, of course, the national uptake is just mind-boggling that other cities either keep the brand or our colleagues in Columbus that like big things, so they call theirs the big table, which I think is terrific.
Very good. Terry, you've got some great questions here. We could be here all afternoon.
It's a great audience.
Of course it is. It's the best. This is the City Club. Give yourself a round of applause. This is from City Club member Marie Lynch, who's CEO of Skills for Chicagoland's Future. Terry, can you share advice based on your learnings from On the Table that organizations can be doing year-round to increase conversations in our neighborhoods to address violence? You know, a couple of weeks when he retires, you'd be paying him $600-$700 an hour.
Marie, I thought you were going to take the question in a different direction there. What I see happening is that when the single conversation is not enough, when people commit to continue to meet and pursue a topic under discussion. And I would welcome using Marie's suggestion to say that for those of you who are concerned about violence, continue to meet, continue to work with people. Hold your meetings in diverse locations, out in communities, include other residents there. Let's partner with the Chicago Police Department and help police officers also to organize these. We don't have to ask Robin Robinson to be the sole organizer and host of hundreds of tables, but for every nonprofit here, you could host a special edition on the table for residents and police officers in whatever district you are in, whether it's someplace you live or where you work or where you have other connections, and just have these pop up on the tables start to spontaneously arise around our community. If we did that all summer, I think it would make a real difference.
Okay, thank you. This is from Jackie Davidoff with the Davidoff Mission-Driven Business Strategy. With so many needs and social issues in our city, how does the trust determine where its resources are best leveraged? Also, to what does the trust hold itself, or to what degree does the trust hold itself accountable?
The beauty of On the Table is it informed and continues to inform the trust strategic plan. The priorities of our funding in the plan were established based on that very first On the Table and what we heard from residents, and we continued to refine that year over year based on what we hear from the community. And that way, I think we're very authentically aligned with the interests of the community. What I love about a community foundation model is there is accountability to the community because our board members are widely representative of various leadership bodies throughout our community as an appointed body. So it is of, for, and by the community, and it's in there that we have our accountability. For the other speech, I'll talk about what keeps me up at night as far as being able to be true to the needs of the community, but that's for another time.
Okay, he will be back. We have two final questions. One from Marianne Grigsby, I believe, Voices for the Children. Her question is, the MPC report you referenced, the cost of segregation, was eye-opening. Have you seen any action from elected officials seeking to address this in concrete ways?
The report has only been out recently, I think. To expect elected officials to be able to act on that in this window is probably not realistic. But I think that it gives all of us a basis to educate and inform our elected officials when we're helping them to think about how do we prioritize and make decisions in our communities. I think that Neighborhood Opportunity Fund is such an example of being able to make investments in neighborhoods so that instead of viewing, say, a neighborhood finally got a Starbucks in its neighborhood, that's simply extracting money out of a neighborhood. But creating a homegrown coffee house with a local entrepreneur who is invested in by our city because our city believes in that individual's ability to run an enterprise and have their own coffee shop that keeps money in the neighborhood and circulates that money. So it's not a one-time transaction of your $3 for a cup of coffee that then flees to a corporate headquarters outside of our city. I think that those are the sorts of smart bets that we'll see more and more of.
Okay, and last but not least, our final question from Lawrence Massal with the Civic Federation. Thank you for bringing public dignity to public discourse. I think we all agree with that. What has surprised you most about Chicago in your role as interim CPS chief and as a relocated Detroiter? You may have to explain that last part.
Okay, Lawrence, that's for that speech. Particularly any comments that I might make about the Chicago Public Schools, I have to be very careful and thoughtful about that. It was an extraordinary, unique experience, as Jesse has also shared. The intensity, the challenges at that time were quite remarkable. What surprises me, though, I think I do have one answer to that, is the lack of our state's commitment to our children. And I know Tasha experiences that, Voices for Illinois Children. It should not even be a question about funding childcare, early childhood education, preschool. That should just be a given. And all of the nonprofits that are seeking funding to open up and provide a modicum of support shouldn't be. And then our difficulties in arriving at a grand bargain that provides equitable funding, it's just very frustrating that we continue to have this conversation. It's been experienced during my entire tenure at the Trust for that. And having moved from Detroit and knowing what a collapsing city looks like, I think that there are a lot of lessons that we should take heed for. And it begins by we have to invest in young people from the youngest all the way through higher education and college. Our state should be knocking the socks off of any other state as far as attractiveness for higher ed opportunities here. Got David Baker with America's Urban Campus, a plug there. 224,000 college students in the Loop area here. 20 institutions, $10 billion of economic impact. Why wouldn't we want to grow that is beyond me.